Stories, awakening, possibility, social impact. Creating a culture of compassion, connection, and collaboration. You are listening to Hollyhock Talks, a podcast about the teachers and luminaries that make Hollyhock extraordinary. Hollyhock is Canada's leading leadership learning center, located on Cortez Island. Hollyhock Talks brings a little piece of Hollyhock magic to you, wherever you are listening. This is Farah Nasrallah of Hollyhock Talks, and I'm thrilled to be here with Stephen Jenkinson, spiritual activist, teacher, author, and ceremonialist, who has worked in the death trade for decades and now teaches Orphan Wisdom School and teaches how to live and die wisely, which is also the name of his newest book, Die Wise, A Manifesto for Sanity and Soul. Thank you for being here, Stephen. It's great to be with you through cyberspace.
It's very kind of you to offer. Thank you. Thanks for the invitation.
I thought I would start by talking a little bit about the title of your program is Die Wise. Can you tell us a little bit about what it means to die wise?
Yeah, I could start by telling you I've been introduced more than once as the author of the book Die Wisely. And you might think, well, it's basically the same meaning, but it's radically different meaning, actually. If I had called the book Die Wisely, then the word wisely refers to your manner of dying. The book is not about that at all. At least it doesn't advocate that as a kind of insurance policy that no matter what kind of life you've lived, you know, no matter how vague you've been on the subject of dying, how reluctant, how reticent, how withdrawn, how aloof you've been with respect to dying. It doesn't mean for one second that when you come to dying, that somehow at the 11th hour and 59th minute, you'll have some magic capacity that you didn't grow or cultivate when you were, you know, more able-bodied and you had more energy and more, if I could use the expression, give a shit. So the book is called Die Wise, by which I'm saying that your manner of dying. This is what I saw many, many years when I was working in the death trade, that people's manner of dying reflected very faithfully their manner of living. And people die the way they lived. And the death phobe, if that was true of a culture that was kind of reasonably sane and healthy where dying is concerned, that would be great news. But the truth of the matter is that most of us grow our entire lives in a culture that is so phobic, so tormented and traumatized and insulted, frankly, by the prospect of dying, that if you die in the manner of your living, you come to your dying as an absolute amateur. And this is very, very bad news, frankly. And, you know, this is what I saw. So the book is called Die Wise, which is an appeal to recognize that the capacity for wisdom when you're dying has to be begun well before you get a, you know, terminal diagnosis or you feel a lump in the shower kind of thing.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that what you're teaching or what you're sharing insights or living in the program that you'll teach and who you are as an example to others is about how to live.
Well, you know, it's not a distinction, frankly, that I make. I know it's a handy one. It's a wonderful soundbite that how you die really is about how you live. You know, at some level, I suppose that's true, but it's rather blithe to say it that way. We should rather say that your dying should be more or less indistinguishable from your living if you've lived as if you'll die someday, you see. So that the whole notion that you, if you eat enough broccoli, think enough good thoughts, you know, cultivate good relationships and all the rest, that somehow this dying won't make a claim upon you, is frankly, forget about naive, but it's frankly dangerous. And here's why. Because it's one thing if it has consequence for you in your life. But imagine that you're a parent, for example, and that you've lived your whole life as if your dying will never happen, and now your kids are bearing witness to the fact that you're grotesquely, not only unready, but deeply unwilling. And that unwillingness can take two forms, no? One of them is that you're, you know, screaming, rising in the middle of the night for no apparent reason. A good candidate for antidepressants or sedation or both. Or is that you opt for euthanasia, at the drop of a hat, basically, at the first sign of real travail, of real labor. Suddenly euthanasia looks like a very good idea. And you're teaching this kind of stuff to people that you claim to love and have loved your whole life or their whole life. My question is this really an act of love to die tormented and underprepared simply because it didn't suit your lifestyle at the time? And I don't think it is.
What I'm also hearing in your answer is that how we die is also determined by our relationship to suffering.
Absolutely. That's very well observed. Yes, that's very true. So here's a question for you. Which I seem to be, better at than answers, frankly.
You're asking me?
Yeah. I'm going to put it out there. Let's say this. I'll put it out there. Here it is. Where does the principle suffering unto death come from? What's its root? If you don't think about it too much, or you don't have much experience in these matters, then the assumption is, well, it comes from the pain, the physical pain, etc. I can assure you now that almost no matter where you live, you will not die writhing in agony. But because the technology is very, very astute, and the practitioners are very good at this. And it's a wonderful thing, don't get me wrong. And yet, most dying people die without a lot of physical torment, and their suffering is absolutely intact, hasn't even been touched, hasn't probably even been wondered about very much. Now, where does that suffering come from? And I'm suggesting to you, it comes from the fact that we come to our dying in exactly the way I've just described to you. That the suffering comes, in a death-phobic culture, the suffering unto death comes from knowing that you're dying, not from dying. And so a death-phobic culture actually is engaged in the business of seeing to it that you don't know this so very, very much, because it's colluding with the idea that it's really knowing about dying that's the cause of all suffering, and the less you know, as it comes on, the less you know that it's coming on, apparently, the less suffering there is. What I'm saying to you, of course, is my experience was that the less you know about it, the more acute and unapproachable that suffering becomes.
So are you saying that the contemplation and the thinking of our death and how we want to die and approaching it face on is part of what allows us to face it with dignity and grace?
Well, the phrase face it makes it sound like a sort of a grim kind of John Wayne movie, a grim country and western song. I'm not sure facing it is the right tone. At least it's not the one that I'm most deeply believe in. I think the idea could be something like this, that dying well, profoundly, doesn't mean without suffering, that the profundity includes your capacity to suffer, because in fact, dying well is exactly that. It's a skill, you see. It's not an endurance test. It's actually a skillfulness that is remarkably akin to the skillfulness that you cultivate when you engage in hard times in your life and in times that aren't hard, and that you bring the same skillfulness of life, of being a real human being, a kind of resonant human being, that in your dying time you become a very reliable and faithful witness to the realities of dying for those who are overseeing your dying, who are visiting you, who are hearing about it, you see. This is what's at stake with every death in North America and elsewhere, that we have some consequence in the deaths of the people that we know and don't know. And that consequence is determined largely by how we ourselves die, such that, our example will be at hand when people who are currently in their teens or 20s or just listening to this as young folk come to their dying time. you know, my way of dying or your manner of dying is what they'll think about. That's what they'll have in front of them. And we have an awful lot to, well, we could say we have consequence in the dying of other people that we don't even frankly know or probably will never meet.
So
in other words, sorry to interrupt you, the last part of that would be then that the dying is first and foremost, you know, it's a village-making proposition. It's not really for your own sake that you undertake to die well. When you realize the deeper consequence of how you do so, you come to the realization that dying is a place, your dying is a place where we could begin to craft again a capacity for something I've come to call village-mindedness. And that's really what's at stake. We either cultivate that village-mindedness by how we die, or we corrode it and corrupt it by how we die.
So what I hear in that is a deep sense of connection to future generations.
Yes, and past generations. Because, of course, our way of dying today in North America doesn't drop out of the sky. You know, strangely and sadly, it's kind of been bequeathed to us that nobody was really reading the fine print on the birth certificate, you know, on the citizenship papers, and on the, you know, we a lot of North American people, frankly, crave a kind of legitimate ancestry that they haven't had much opportunity to learn about when they were kids. And so they go marauding the countryside trying to steal, you know, indigenous people's, you know, spiritual tradition, to take an example.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm saying is, you know, our manner of dying testifies to a certain poverty that's the root condition of being a generic, dominant culture North American person today. If that's true, and I'm persuaded beyond doubt that it is, then we got our dying from those people, you know, who not so many generations ago were frankly not doing that well in the ancestry department. We can do something about that by how we die. And it's not by turning away from the ancestors that have granted us a rather grim understanding of what it means to be alive, to be human, to be a social person and a cultivated person and the rest. In other words, dying well is a redemptive proposition, not a salvific one. It redeems what has come before you by being conducted as if, you know, X number of generations from now, people will be informed in their dying by how you and I do it. That's the kind of thing that's at stake.
So when you say redemptive, are you also speaking of the redemptive capacity of our ancestors? Our ability to redeem the history and create a different kind of legacy?
Exactly. You said it probably better than I just did. That's exactly what's available to us, but it's also what's at stake. So I don't want to make it sound like a kind of spiritual supermarket, you know? And I don't want to make it sound like it's a wonderful time. It's a very trying time, obviously, to be dying. It's a challenging, hurtful, heartbreaking, you know, thing that nobody really counted on. So the personal sorrows are one thing, but the realization is that your dying has consequence for people to come is something that, let's say, puts your personal heartbreak in the kind of proper scale of things, and that you can actually act not as if — it's not a good formulation in English because it makes it sound like it's possibly not so — but you can proceed with the learning that will be available to future generations in your hands. If you die that way, no matter what the cause of your death is, you know, medically speaking, the achievement will be something that you won't see, of course, but will be directly, let's say, traceable to some shift that might occur in, let's say, your generation over realizing that dying is not something you own. You know, your dying doesn't actually belong to you at all. It's entrusted to you for the sake of these generations to come, as you've so well said.
Okay, so now I'm convinced on the importance of this, of cultivating this skillfulness. So tell the people who are listening how to cultivate the skill of village-mindedness.
if you weren't as like, I was born as white as it's possible to get, okay?
Mm-hmm.
If you look up white in the dictionary, you'll find me and the likes of me. And frankly, white people aren't wild about being white these days. It's understandable why. There's a rather grim history that accrued, you know, colonial history and the rest. And it's vital that we know about this, because our manner of dying, believe it or not, is informed by that kind of ragged, tyrannical history that we inflicted on, you know, across the globe, frankly, over the last 300 or 400 years. So if that's true, and I'm persuaded that it is, that our manner of dying is taking place in the presence of the fact that we're living off the avails of what was done, you know, colonially and imperially and the rest. It's a present reality. It's not a past reality. Village-mindedness means that you're willing to proceed as if you didn't get a vote in what your ancestors did in the world, neither did I. We do, however, get a vote in whether we're going to proceed as if they did what they did. And the way we do it is not by abandoning them for the sake of someone else's ancestors, like the victim's ancestors, for example, but we proceed instead like these people are still our people. And if you believe, or if your experience suggests to you, that when you die, that's not the end of everything, that there is some kind of residual continuance. Okay, I don't pretend to know the architecture of it, but let's imagine that there is.
That's a very interesting term. I like that.
Yeah. Neutral as I can get it, you know, without intentionally offending anybody. But imagine if that's so. Then imagine that your manner of dying, and Buddhist people are very, very strong in this understanding, that your manner of dying determines a lot about what becomes of you, quote, after death, right?
Yes.
But unfortunately, I think that sold in that circumstance is, you know, it's good for you to die well. And you hear me saying that it's actually good for your people for you to die well. That's a one iteration of what constitutes village-mindedness. Big stuff, huh?
Mm-hmm. Very
big
much.
Stuff. I think so. Yeah, what's the next question?
I don't know.
Now what?
Well, I don't really know where to go from here, except I just want to sit and really contemplate and think and reflect on this.
Yeah. Yeah, properly so, I think. You know, we don't have to, you know, fill up all kinds of time with filler. We could imagine that the consequences to what you and I have just been talking about are so vast and so unexpected. There's too much riding on it. And it'd just be my little death, like the good old days. Now that the demand for euthanasia, that it's being claimed as a right now, you see, when actually it's a problem-solving device. That's what euthanasia is. The problem is that nobody's talking about what problem does it solve. If it's supposed to solve, quote, suffering, I can assure you of this, that what happens in the wake of euthanasia doesn't end when that person takes whatever they take or have administered to them, whatever it is. Everybody doesn't sit there and go, well, finally a happy outcome. That's not the inevitable consequence. So when people take their dying into their own hands and decide and die when they feel like it, when it suits them, there's enormous consequence to the people that they leave behind, because the whisper campaign that ensues from it is, you know, you really don't owe anything to dying. You don't have to do anything in particular. You can do it when and how you want and whatever suits you. Does that not sound like the consumer culture wants it to sound, like it's another lifestyle option? Mm-hmm. And that's what's going to happen in this country. There's no question about it. You can tell from the kind of discourse that's out there that this is exactly what it's going to turn into. It's another lifestyle choice. And if the things that you and I are talking about are indeed at stake, I wonder what the consequence is of claiming, you know, yet again that this death is our own to do with as we see fit.
So what you're saying is that the way that we're moving in this country towards the right to die is that it has an implication in the residual continuation after death, and does nothing in terms of redemption of our ancestors or future generations.
Well, yes, in a nutshell, I guess I would say this. I'm not saying that it does nothing. I'm saying that it's the discourse, okay? It's not the act itself. It's what it's going to come to mean. That's the thing that concerns me most. I mean, people listening to this thinking that I'm somehow anti-euthanasia. That's not true. I'm not pro-euthanasia either. What I am is a human being who's deeply concerned that the meaning that we are going to make of dying as a result of opting for euthanasia is something that's not even being talked about. And it's the future generations that are going to inherit that muteness and that unwillingness to be clear and to be candid about what we've put into motion. Man, does that sound like the ecological problems that mm-hmm. we have, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
I think it comes from the same mind that doesn't want to know the consequences of what it claims that it has the right to. Just as once upon a time, you know, everybody believed we had the right to everything that was in the ground, or everything that was in the air, or everything that's coursing down the river stream. And, you know, now we have a right to die. What a strange concept.
Mm-hmm. And what I hear from what you're saying is the sense of entitlement to life.
Yeah. Imagine that death is a god. It doesn't belong to a god. It is the presence of the divine among us. Imagine that dying is one of those gods. I'm frankly persuaded that it is. The question is, what does the presence of this god in your life ask of you? Does it ask of you that you take your life out of the hands of this god called death and reclaim it for yourself and defy this god and rebuke this god and abandon utterly this god or what this god is asking of you, and you come to this god as nothing more than an executioner? Is that really the story that we want to continue to live? Or could we imagine instead that when your dying appears to you, that it's asking something from you, it's not doing something to you, just the way all gods have done with humans, asking not as a Ten Commandment kind of thing, but as a way of, let's say, becoming the fullest expression of what we understood our humanity to be. I think that's what dying is. It's one of the deeper expressions of your understanding what it means to be human. And this God is giving you a chance to be human that way. That's what I'm saying.
Well, that's a whole different orientation towards death, to view it as an invitation to make us more fully human.
Mm-hmm. It's our humanity that's at stake, which is another way of saying it's our village-mindedness that's at stake, because that's where our humanity is to be found. Not in our personal views or beliefs, but in how we conduct ourselves with each other, with the rest of the world that's not human, and with, if I could call it this, the unseen world. Those three stages upon which we appear and act and live and die are the expression of our humanity or its detriment.
Mm-hmm. Well, now I feel like I really want to come to the program that you're offering in July.
I'm glad you do, because we can hit these kind of heights, you see. And the beautiful thing is we're not limited to half an hour when we're sitting there together, you know, at that place. We have hours to ponder these things and really approach them, you know, in a kind of prayerful and deliberate way, not in a contentious, opinion-driven way, but in a way that's mostly characterized by wonder. That's the way I'm coming to it, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm going to wonder out loud with people about these things and how things have come to be as they are among us and whether it could possibly be otherwise in our lifetime. And obviously I'm proceeding like, not only can it be otherwise, it must be. And you hear that kind of urgency in my voice and in what I'm saying to you.
Now tell me your relationship with Hollyhock Into the Land. Surely you've done many programs there. Do you find it to be a very conducive place for this kind of contemplation?
You know, it can be. There's no magic in any particular place, let's say, coaxing us towards sanity. Not really. Not that I've seen. But obviously, I mean, the settings are remarkable. You're on the ocean. One of the things that the ocean is and has been for humans for an awful long time is a kind of incarnation of something vast and uncharted, unknowable, frankly, and profound beyond belief, something like dying, you know. And the beauty of the place is not something that is conquered or defeated by dying. I mean, that beauty's there. And what I'm saying is the teaching, the wondering about dying, and finally the dying itself can be something that carries that beauty in it. Instead of saying, well, now that I'm dying, you know, what's the point of you know, admiring a beautiful ocean or an eagle flying overhead, or because it doesn't mean anything anymore. No, it still does. It always will. And your dying can be as majestic as that, you know, that view from the beach at Hollyhock. And frankly, it has to be now. So that's kind of what I'm after, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I feel I have enough to really reflect on, and I don't feel the need to ask any more questions because you've said a lot in this short time.
It's true, yeah.
I really want to thank you.
Well, you know, I appreciate that you have some. I can tell, you know, over and above whatever the assignment was to talk to me about this, that you have something like a kind of inquisitiveness that's connected to your heart instead of to your curiosity, if I could put it that way, that there's something deeper than curiosity that comes from what you said and you know, what you asked me. And, you know, I'm doing this for, I don't know how old you are, of course, but I'm doing this, frankly, with people your age in mind. That's why I'm proceeding the way I am. And that's why I appreciate the fact that, you know, you've made time in your life to talk about these things, ask me real questions, and being willing to respond as if I tried to give you a real answer. So hopefully between the two of us, we earned our keep today.
I certainly hope so. Thank you. Thank you so much. It's been a real gift for me to do this, to have this opportunity, and I certainly hope that that will be the case for those who listen as well.
Amen. Thank you.
Stories, awakening, possibility, social impact. Creating a culture of compassion, connection, and collaboration. You are listening to Hollyhock Talks, a podcast about the teachers and luminaries that make Hollyhock extraordinary. Hollyhock is Canada's leading leadership learning center, located on Cortez Island. Hollyhock Talks brings a little piece of Hollyhock magic to you, wherever you are listening.